The Federal News Update for Thursday, January 1st, 2026. Welcome back to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson, and we are opening up the archives because December 31st was, well, it was anything but a holiday.
Not at all.
It was a day of intense strategic positioning and, you know, administrative cleanup across the entire federal apparatus. We are undertaking an exhaustive deep dive into the very final day of 2025. Activity.
And good to be here. Our mission today is maximum granularity. We are dissecting this transition point, systematically reviewing the government structure from, you know, the top all the way down.
But it seems like this day wasn't just administrative housekeeping.
No, not at all. It was a full-scale tactical repositioning for 2026.
All right.
We need to dissect not just what happened, but the operational mechanics and I think the long-term strategic implications of every single announcement, veto, and report from the White House right through the judiciary.
I appreciate that commitment to detail because the White House sources alone show a highly calibrated application of economic hard power right before the new year. Let's unpack this, starting with the Executive Office of the President, the EOP, and a very significant move on trade policy.
Okay, so we begin with the EOP's strategic management of the domestic timber supply chain.
And that ties directly into the housing market.
It ties directly into the, well, the very volatile housing market.
The action itself was President Donald J. Trump exercising authority under Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962. Now, for our listeners, this is a specific mechanism that allows the president to adjust import levels if the Secretary of Commerce says they pose a threat to national security.
That's the legal basis, yes.
So what was the resulting proclamation and what did it specifically adjust?
The action was a, quote, proclamation on adjusting imports of timber, lumber, and their derivative products. And the key detail here, Alex, is the nuance of the economic target. The proclamation explicitly delays the increase in tariff rates for very specific finished goods.
Finished goods. So not the raw lumber.
Exactly. Not the raw materials. We're talking about, and I'm quoting here, upholstered furniture, kitchen cabinets, and vanities.
Finished goods that are key components for the U.S. residential real estate sector. So for the listener, what is the new timeline? When does that tariff escalation actually kick in now?
The new effective date for the escalation is pushed back one full year. It's now January 1st, 2027.
Okay, but there's a critical financial caveat here that people need to understand, isn't there?
There is. The existing 25% tariff that was already in place, the one that came from a previous proclamation on September 25th, 2025, that remains in full legal force in effect.
So, to be perfectly clear, this is not a tariff reduction.
No. It's a delay on further tariff increases and only for these very specific finished products.
Okay, what's the strategic rationale then? Why keep the existing 25% tariff on the raw materials, but delay the increase only on finished consumer goods?
Well, the justification is multi-layered. First, you have the core national security argument. That remains. The Secretary of Commerce determined that an over-reliance on foreign timber products threatens the resilience of the domestic wood industry, which is, you know, vital for defense logistics and infrastructure.
Sure, that's the standard Section 232 argument.
It is. But second, and this is probably the more immediate reason, the delay on the finished goods is a clear anti-inflationary measure targeted directly at consumers.
How so?
Well, if the tariff on cabinets and vanities had spiked on January 1st, 2026, it would have immediately driven up costs for builders and, you know, consequently for American homebuyers.
So this acts as a targeted stabilizer for the housing market in 2026. It prevents an immediate price shock that would have undercut their economic growth narratives.
Precisely.
And beyond that domestic stabilization, what is the international trade impact?
The international impact is, well, it's a masterstroke of leverage. The action text notes the U.S. is still engaging in, quote, productive negotiations with trade partners. By pushing the tariff increase back one year, the administration maintains the threat of future escalation.
It's just hanging over exporting nations.
Exactly. It's hanging over Canada and our Asian trade partners. It functions as a geopolitical sword of Damocles, so to speak.
So it incentivizes foreign exporters to offer concessions now in 2026 to secure a better deal and avoid those much higher tariffs slated for 2027.
That's exactly it. And it sets a powerful precedent reinforcing the administration's interpretation of that 1962 act that economic security, particularly the cost drivers in the domestic housing market, is, well, it's inextricably linked to national security.
That is a fascinating example of high stakes, last minute policy calibration. Okay, moving from economic statecraft to diplomacy and workforce management, What was the president doing in the final days of the year?
We saw an intense diplomatic sprint, and it signals that major foreign policy initiatives are, I mean, they're certainly planned for early quarter one of 2026.
What were the key meetings?
The key bilateral meetings leading right up to December 31st included a meeting with the Prime Minister of Israel on December 29th, and then another with Ukrainian President Zelensky on December 28th.
And the stated goal.
The White House explicitly stated the goal of both meetings was focused on ending that war.
Holding these high-stakes meetings at the Mar-a-Lago Winter White House and grouping them so closely together, I mean, that suggests the administration is preparing to unveil some coordinated, significant peace frameworks or maybe armistice proposals. It feels like a positioning move.
Precisely. It positions the president as the necessary central broker of global stability right as the new year begins. And then on the domestic messaging front, we also saw the ceremonial side.
Right, the video release.
The White House released a video titled "The 2025 Season Comes to an End." It frames the presidency in these highly narrative, sort of media-centric terms. And he also attended a New Year's Eve party.
Which is not just a social event.
No, it's a ceremonial display. It projects vitality and continued accessibility at the peak of administrative authority.
And for the federal workforce, we have two critical signals, starting with compensation. The trending news noted that a White House executive order cements the scheduled 1% raise for federal workers.
Right, which keeps them at a stable compensation floor.
But the other headline is politically massive. Trump signs executive order to block state AI regulations.
That EO confirms the administration's strategy of federal preemption in the technology sphere. I mean, they are signaling their intent to manage the federal workforce's compensation while at the same time tackling the highly controversial issue of artificial intelligence regulation.
So by blocking states from creating a patchwork system of rules, what's the argument?
The argument is that a consistent, streamlined federal approach is essential to prevent stifling innovation. They want to ensure the federal approach will dominate the AI regulatory landscape.
Okay, let's pivot sharply to domestic enforcement and the judicial pushback the White House experienced regarding the use of the National Guard. What was the administrative action and what was the immediate cause?
So the what? The administration announced the removal of the National Guard units from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Portland. And the why? This was a necessary reversal following a loss at the Supreme Court.
What did the court rule specifically?
The court ruled that the president's crime reduction justification for deploying the guard to these cities was legally insufficient under the relevant statutes.
The court effectively put the brakes on using the National Guard for these broad-based local law enforcement roles that, you know, traditionally belong to state and municipal police. What was the administration's immediate messaging after the withdrawal?
President Trump used social media to manage the public expectation. He asserted that the National Guard had greatly reduced crime, but then he issued a clear warning.
Let me guess. We'll be back.
Essentially, yes. He said, and I quote, "We will come back perhaps in a much different and stronger form when crime begins to soar again." This sets a public expectation that the return of federal security forces is, well, inevitable should crime rates rebound.
Reinforcing the law and order brand despite the judicial loss.
Exactly.
Shifting to legislative actions, we saw two seemingly low-profile bipartisan bills vetoed right at the deadline. But the reasons, they appear highly political. What were the bills and what was the subtext here?
Okay, the first was legislation related to a drinking water pipeline. The political drama here involved the bill's primary sponsor, Republican Congresswoman Lauren Boebert.
Who is normally a close ally of the president.
Normally, yes. But she had recently broken ranks to push for the release of the Jeffrey Epstein files, which is, as you know, a major point of political friction right now.
So it's fair to read this veto as having a clear political subtext. It's potentially punishing a key ally for a breach in loyalty on a high visibility, very sensitive issue.
I think that's a very reasonable interpretation.
And what about the second veto?
The second veto targeted legislation designed to give the Muskusuki tribe of Indians of Florida more control of their tribal lands. And the veto letter, Alex, was astonishingly explicit about the reason. It linked it directly to the administration's core immigration agenda.
Tell us the specific language of the veto letter.
The letter stated that the Muskusuki tribe has actively sought to obstruct reasonable immigration policies.
And that's a direct reference to their opposition to the Alligator Alcatraz Immigration Detention Center.
It's an unambiguous reference to their public opposition to that proposed facility, which is planned for a remote location in the Everglades.
That name, Alligator Alcatraz, paints a pretty vivid picture of the proposed location remote, hostile, difficult to access. This veto really demonstrates the raw application of executive leverage.
It absolutely does. This signals that non-cooperation on key policy priorities, like immigration enforcement, will result in administrative retaliation across the entire spectrum of unrelated domestic legislation. It's a clear message.
That presidential power is being used to punish political opposition.
Even when that opposition comes from a federally recognized tribe seeking control over its own ancestral lands.
That concludes a thorough look at the White House's balancing act. Let's transition now into the Department of the Treasury, where we see the application of financial hard power against foreign adversaries contrasted sharply with a massive regulatory retreat domestically.
We can begin with the hard power, the Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, targeting the Venezuelan shadow fleet.
What's fascinating here is the technical precision of this financial strike. So the Treasury's OFAC executed a targeted sanctions package pursuant to Executive Order 13850.
And that EO specifically targets the illicit oil revenue network supporting the Maduro regime.
We need the technical identifiers to really understand the precision here.
Okay. Four specific entities and four associated vessels were designated and blocked. These include Corniola Limited and Crepe Myrtle Co. LTD, both associated with the vessel Nord Star.
And they use the IMO numbers, the International Maritime Organization numbers.
Always. For the Nord Star, that's IMO 9323596. They also designated Winky International Limited, associated with the vessel Rosalind, which was specifically noted as operating under an alias.
The alias being Lunartide.
Right, Lunartide, IMO 9277735. And that alias just underscores how rapidly sanctions evasion trade crafts evolve.
Yeah, absolutely. What else?
Finally, Aries Global Investment LTD was designated, and this one was associated with two vessels, Della, which is IMO 9227479, and Valiant, IMO 9409247. The inclusion of those IMO numbers is critical.
Why? What does that do?
It tells port authorities, customs agents, and insurance firms exactly which physical asset is now blocked. There's no ambiguity.
So why is targeting the vessels themselves rather than just the state oil company so effective?
It's about dismantling the physical logistics chain. By designating a vessel with its IMO number, it becomes toxic in the maritime industry.
Toxic how?
It loses access to reputable insurance, it can't enter allied ports, and it can't be serviced by legitimate firms or crewed by professional mariners. This forces the Maduro regime to rely on increasingly decrepit and unsafe vessels, which significantly raises the cost of export and increases the risk of, you know, an environmental catastrophe.
So it applies severe indirect geopolitical pressure.
Exactly. It's a clear geopolitical signal reaffirming the maximum pressure campaign against Venezuela, timed perfectly for the new year. It hits them on their weakest link logistics.
Okay, now let's talk about the massive domestic policy reversal. The Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, FinCEN, suspending the Corporate Transparency Act, the CTA.
Right. So the Treasury Department announced the suspension of enforcement for the CTA, but only for U.S. citizens and domestic reporting companies.
And the detail here is key.
The detail is, effective December 31st, 2025, FinCEN will not enforce penalties for failure to report beneficial ownership information, the BOI, against domestic entities. This is huge. It could affect tens of millions of small businesses, LLCs, and S-Corps that were required to register their ultimate owners.
And the CTA was designed specifically to combat money laundering through anonymous shell companies. This suspension is a major rollback.
It is a major rollback of anti-money laundering regulations.
So what's the official rationale for this deregulatory deleveraging?
Well, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent framed this as a cornerstone of an ambitious economic growth agenda designed to rein in burdensome regulations and re-leverage the private sector.
So the argument is about reducing compliance costs for American small businesses.
It is. The argument is that those costs outweigh the law enforcement benefits.
But strategically, this also signals a concession amid what was a massive legal challenge, correct?
Exactly. This decision comes amid ongoing nationwide injunctions, most notably the Texas Top Cop Shop Inc. versus Garland case. The administration is essentially conceding the battlefield administratively to avoid the risk of a final, crushing judicial ruling against the law itself.
The immediate impact, then, is a potential intelligence gap for law enforcement regarding illicit finance.
That is the fear, especially if actors can effectively mask their foreign connections. Now, FinCEN does plan to issue an interim final rule, which means a rule published quickly without the standard lengthy comment period to narrow the CTA scope to cover only foreign reporting companies.
But the exemption of domestic entities means the U.S. might remain a pretty favorable jurisdiction for forming anonymous shell companies.
It might, and this regulatory slowdown seems deliberate. We also saw Treasury delay the effective date of a separate anti-money laundering rule until January 1st, 2028. It all points in the same direction.
Moving from Treasury to the Pentagon, the Department of Defense concluded the year with a massive financial commitment to infrastructure and critical workforce initiatives. Let's start with the major contract award at Eglin Air Force Base.
Okay. The what? DOD executed a major contract award for the operations and maintenance, or O&M, of the Eglin Test and Training Complex and major ground test facilities at Eglin Air Force Base in Florida.
And we need to understand the scale here. What were the specific terms? What was the value?
The detail. The contract was awarded to a company called Strategic Test Solutions, LLC, which is classified as a small business based in Huntsville, Alabama. The contract vehicle is an indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity, or IDIQ, service contract.
A flexible mechanism for long-term services.
Right. And the number you need to remember is the total ceiling value. $1,858,902,857. So approximately $1.87 billion.
A nearly $2 billion commitment. And the time frame?
The period of performance is extensive. It extends all the way through March of 2036.
That is a 10-year commitment. Why is Eglin Air Force Base so critical to warrant this size and duration?
Well, the why is that Eglin is the primary hub for the Air Force Armament Directorate. It is the crucial testing and validation ground for high-priority development programs, specifically hypersonic missiles and smart munitions.
So securing a stable, decade-long O&M partner is vital for continuity in these next-generation weapons programs.
It is absolutely vital.
And what are the broader economic implications of awarding this contract to a Huntsville, Alabama-based small business?
The impact here is that it aligns directly with the DOD's stated goal to expand the defense industrial base, the DIB, beyond the traditional prime contractors like Lockheed or Raytheon.
Right.
And crucially, it powerfully reinforces the concept of the Southern Defense Corridor. It strategically links the missile expertise centered in Huntsville, Alabama, home to Redstone Arsenal, with the crucial testing ranges in the Florida Panhandle.
So it's integrating this dense, specialized engineering ecosystem that's critical for advancing national security capabilities.
That's the goal.
Okay. That concentration of capability is powerful, but it also raises questions about centralized risk, which we'll circle back to. What other policy deadlines hit the DIB right on December 31st?
Two critical policies had a hard stop. First, the temporary authority granted by the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA, which allowed the DOD to modify contracts for inflation relief. That expired on December 31st, 2025.
And the impact of that?
The impact is a definitive hard stop for defense contractors. Unless Congress grants a swift extension, contractors can no longer seek equitable adjustments for surging material and labor costs, which could significantly squeeze their margins in 2026.
And that could potentially impact the smaller suppliers most severely.
It could, yes.
What was the second industrial policy deadline?
Defense agencies were finalizing the updating of their compliance frameworks to screen out prohibited Chinese biotechnology firms. This is necessary to comply with the recently enacted Biosecure Act, which involves a massive administrative and supply chain auditing effort, a huge effort that had to be completed by the end of the year to ensure procurement integrity moving into the new fiscal quarter.
Let's touch quickly on administrative changes within the Office of the Secretary of Defense.
Sure. A DOD memorandum required the transition of all executive assistant, or EA, support within OSD to a single award vehicle by December 31st.
Just standardizing professional support services across the headquarters.
Right. Also finalized was an administrative adjustment to the 2026 government meal rate. Effective January 1st, 2026, this rate increases to $18 per day.
Reflecting rising food costs impacting service members.
Exactly, especially those deployed or traveling.
Now, here is where the technological and workforce shift becomes unmistakable. The Army's major push into artificial intelligence. They are establishing a brand new, dedicated career path.
This is a big one. The what? The Army is establishing a dedicated artificial intelligence and machine learning career field for officers. It's designated as the new 49B specialty.
And what does that mean in practice?
The detail is that this formally recognizes AI and machine learning, not as an ancillary skill, but as an official area of concentration for officers. It places it on par with traditional combat or intelligence specialties.
This sounds like a fundamental change in how the Army views technological leadership. So how does an officer actually transition into this high-demand specialty, and what's the commitment?
They can apply via the Voluntary Transfer Incentive Program, the VTIP, starting January 5th. Selected officers are expected to formally transfer by October of 2026. And crucially, they incur a 3-year active duty service obligation after completing the required graduate level training.
Who are they looking for?
They are prioritizing highly competitive candidates, specifically those who already hold advanced degrees or have demonstrated technical experience in AI and data science fields.
The need for this dedicated cadre must be urgent. What is the explicit strategic justification? Why grow this talent internally instead of relying purely on contractors?
Well, Army spokesperson Lieutenant Colonel Orlandon Howard stated the goal is building a dedicated cadre of in-house experts who will accelerate the Army's transformation into a data-centric, AI-enabled force.
And this aligns with a broader mandate.
It directly aligns with a broader mandate from Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, who directed the Army to enable AI-driven command and control at headquarters by 2027. They need internal expertise that understands both the technology and the doctrine.
And this 49B specialty is part of a larger technological push, right? Integrating both talent and platforms.
Exactly. This is just one piece of a broader transformation. It includes the creation of a new robotics tech warrant officer career field. We also saw the administration bring in 4 senior executives from tech giants like Palantir and Meta, swearing them in as direct commission officers into Detachment 201.
The service's new Executive Innovation Corps.
That's right. And on top of that, the DoD itself launched Gemini.mil, leveraging Google Cloud's Gemini for Government to put frontier AI models directly into the hands of warfighters for decision support.
Moving from defense to homeland security, the final day of the year marked the culmination of a major enforcement surge and a significant policy sunset in immigration. Let's start with the stick side, Operation Worst of the Worst.
Okay, the what? Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, concluded Operation Worst of the Worst. This was a high-visibility interior enforcement surge focusing on undocumented non-citizens who had been convicted of violent or heinous crimes.
The messaging was aggressive. What specific examples did DHS Public Affairs highlight to reinforce their law and order branding?
The DHS Public Affairs messaging explicitly contrasted the arrests with the holiday season, to try and maximize public vigilance and support. Specific arrests highlighted included an Artemio Gabriel Perez, arrested in Scott County, Kentucky, for rape in the second degree.
Okay.
Another key arrest was Efren Cortez Velez in Passaic, New Jersey, convicted of child cruelty and criminal trespassing. The emphasis was always placed on the seriousness and violence of the prior convictions to justify the enforcement action.
Now let's talk about the policy sunset, which represents the expiration of the carrot side of their strategy.
Yeah, so the Voluntary Repatriation Incentive Program expired precisely at midnight on December 31st, 2025.
And the detail on that program?
This program had offered illegal aliens a $3,000 stipend and a free flight home if they chose to self-deport using the CBP Home app before the deadline.
So the impact here is a definitive strategic pivot for the new year.
Yes. The impact is a hard pivot for 2026. The financial incentive has been removed, making the contrast with the enhanced interior enforcement all the more stark. The logical next phase is an escalation in involuntary removal operations.
And they can use the data from the app to target people.
Well, you have to assume they can use enforcement data to identify and target those who might have registered or inquired via the app, but ultimately chose not to depart voluntarily.
Before leaving DHS, there's a key administrative friction point involving the workforce at the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA.
Yes. The what? The Department of Homeland Security agreed to push back plans to dissolve the union agreement for airport screeners. The detail. The TSA delayed the effective date of eliminating the American Federation of Government Employees, the AFGE, collective bargaining agreement.
From when to when?
From January 11th to January 18th. And this delay was mandatory to allow for court arguments over the union's motion for an emergency order.
Because a judge had already issued a preliminary injunction?
Exactly. An injunction was already in place, blocking an earlier attempt by the administration to dissolve the contract unilaterally.
This keeps the union agreement in place for now, but underscores the ongoing legal battle over federal workforce rights within critical security agencies, a theme we see recurring across government.
It is a recurring theme, yes.
Okay. Shifting to infrastructure, FEMA awarded grant money for counter-drone security.
Right. The what? FEMA awarded grants under a counter-unmanned aircraft system, or CUAS, program, the detail. $250 million was awarded to 11 states and the National Capital Region.
And these are all locations hosting the FIFA World Cup next summer.
That's right. This CUAS grant program was established with $500 million from the massive One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which means the remaining $250 million will be distributed next year.
And the why is pretty obvious. To help defend against unauthorized drone activity during a major international event.
Exactly. It's about getting state and local law enforcement the necessary counter-drone technologies to secure those areas.
And the DHS Science and Technology Directorate is aligning its R&D goals with this enforcement focus.
Precisely. DHS Science and Technology announced new R&D priorities for 2026, focusing heavily on supporting the enforcement and security posture we just discussed. So next-generation border surveillance, advanced biometric identity management, and, of course, enhanced counter-drone technologies. The mission is clear: technological support for enforcement and protection.
Now we move into the nexus of critical infrastructure and persistent workforce crises, starting with the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, and its monumental task of overhauling the U.S. air traffic control system.
It is the single largest modernization effort underway.
So the
FAA is on an aggressive schedule to completely replace the aging air traffic control system within 3 years.
And the detail on the funding.
FAA Administrator Brian Bedford told Congress the agency expects to obligate more than $6 billion this fiscal year, FY 2026, and this comes from the $12.5 billion provided by Congress as a down payment in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act.
$6 billion is a massive obligation targeted at foundational modernization. What specific areas are receiving that money?
The funds are for modernizing telecommunications and air surveillance systems. This means replacing legacy copper circuits with fiber optics and, crucially, re-architecting the fiber layout.
That layout issue was exposed by the Dallas-Fort Worth outage, wasn't it?
It was. Administrator Bedford noted that the DFW outage exposed architecture flaws, where the system was theoretically modernized but lacked the necessary resilience due to poor fiber layout design.
Where does the FAA stand on completing this telecommunications overhaul, given the urgency?
Bedford reported that the telco modernization is only about 35% complete, with a projected finish in the third quarter of fiscal year 2027. It just highlights the enormous scale and complexity, even with dedicated funding.
To manage this gargantuan project, they brought in a prime integrator, which must have come with some strict performance incentives.
They hired Periton as the prime integrator, and the contract structure is highly instructive.
How so?
Periton's profit is tied to three elements. First, a 3% fixed profit. Second, a very significant 6% variable profit, which is entirely contingent on their performance across 14 identified critical needs work packages. And third, a 3% held back for potential damages if they fail to comply.
That profit structure is designed to mitigate the historical risk of bloated contracts and endless delays.
It puts the financial risk back on the contractor.
But let's talk about the overall cost. $12.5 billion plus this $6 billion obligation, is that enough?
Not even close. The agency testified they need another $20 billion on top of the $12.5 billion down payment. But what's truly alarming is how the FAA uses its standard annual modernization funding, the approximately $5 billion they usually receive.
What did he say about that?
Bedford stated that 80% of the agency's infrastructure is currently considered obsolete and or unsustainable.
So the vast majority of the annual funding doesn't go toward building new systems. It goes toward triage.
That's right. Bedford testified that 85 to 90% of those annual funds are actually used for sustainment, repairing, painting, or replacing elevators and HVAC systems and plumbing and roofs. And his exact quote was devastating.
What was it?
He said, "Frankly, we're putting lipstick on a pig. So you may think you're buying brand new infrastructure with the $5 billion, but what you're buying is sustainment of the old system."
Wow. That quote, "we're putting lipstick on a pig," is a damning self-critique that summarizes the depth of the technological debt facing the entire federal government. But infrastructure isn't the only crisis here. There's a serious workforce issue.
A huge one. Senator Tammy Duckworth highlighted the crisis, noting a shortage of 3,500 air traffic controllers,
forcing 60-hour work weeks
at over 90% of airports nationwide. She stated emphatically that placing the lives of constituents in the hands of overworked and utterly exhausted civil servants is unacceptable and dangerous.
So what's the FAA's plan to remedy this severe controller shortage?
Under their separate initiative, Flight Plan 2026, the FAA plans to hire 8,900 new controllers by 2028. However, they faced a recent setback where a government shutdown caused an estimated 500 people to withdraw from training programs.
And that has a direct operational impact.
It does. The operational impact saw safety-related air traffic slowdowns, they call them staffing triggers, rise from mere single digits before the lapse to more than 80 in a single day. It's a direct link between staffing instability and operational risk.
Let's shift to the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, and a looming crisis that was successfully averted right at the deadline, the telemedicine cliff.
Right. So the DEA and HHS issued the fourth temporary extension of COVID-19 telemedicine flexibilities for prescription of controlled medications.
And the detail here is about the Ryan Haight Act.
Exactly. This action prevented the expiration of waivers granted under the Ryan Haight Act, which is a 2008 law that normally prohibits remote prescribing of controlled substances without a prior in-person evaluation. We're talking about essential maintenance drugs like Adderall and buprenorphine.
And what is the duration of this fourth extension?
It's granted through December 31st, 2026. And the why was to prevent a sudden healthcare cliff where millions of patients would have abruptly lost access to their essential medications on New Year's Day.
The fact that this is the fourth temporary extension, I mean, that just underscores the immense difficulty the agencies are having in drafting permanent rules that balance patient access with law enforcement concerns over the rise of digital pill mills.
It absolutely does. It buys the DEA and HHS another year to digest the record volume of public comments and navigate the complexities of regulating digital health. The regulatory challenge is immense because the system was just not built for a remote reality.
Now, let's look at another major HHS initiative, the National Institutes of Health's All of Us Research Program. An audit from the HHS Office of Inspector General highlighted severe security gaps. What were the key findings?
The OIG audit, led by Charles Summers, found several severe security gaps. This is for a program with over 600,000 participants already enrolled.
Finding one.
Inadequate access controls allowed access to the systems from abroad by employees. A major security red flag. Finding two, the system permitted research participants to download data despite policies and procedures explicitly restricting it.
Which is a huge risk.
It's a huge risk. Summers described this memorably as having a scary sign on an unlocked door.
Allowing participants to download genomic data creates massive downstream security risks. What else did the OIG find regarding NIH's oversight?
Finding three, the NIH failed to inform the Data Research Center awardee, the contractor running the infrastructure, that genomic data should be treated as a national security concern. This omission critically impacted the DRC's risk assessments.
Meaning the system was likely operating at an insufficient security classification.
That's right. And finding four, the DRC was not timely remediating its own security findings, failing to align with federal requirements and contract timeframes for correcting vulnerabilities.
So the security lapses were both structural and administrative. What did the OIG recommend with the most urgency?
The OIG prioritized the access controls, enforcing remote user restrictions and blocking unauthorized downloads. The urgency stems from the core value proposition of the program. If participants cannot trust that their sensitive data is secure, the program fails. And NIH concurred with all the findings.
We've seen these workforce and technology struggles in the FAA and NIH. Let's look at the Office of Personnel Management, OPM, and the persistent issues surrounding federal retirement processing.
Okay. The what? OPM Director Scott Kupor addressed congressional concern over severe retirement processing delays. The why? Kupor touted a new digital system and argued that outdated systems, rather than insufficient staffing levels, are primarily to blame for the bottlenecks.
And the challenges were explicitly exacerbated by the flood of paperwork from the Deferred Resignation Program, the DRP.
That's right. And the DRP is now under severe scrutiny for its cost. The organization Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, or PEER, urged the Government Accountability Office to launch an investigation into the program's extensive use of administrative leave.
PEER estimates the DRP cost the taxpayer about $10 billion. That's a staggering figure.
It is, and it's based on thousands of federal employees spending months on paid leave, despite an official limit of only 10 administrative leave days per year.
Is there any counterargument to this staggering $10 billion estimate, or does that figure stand as a hard measure of administrative waste?
Well, the push for the GAO investigation suggests that OPM itself may contest that number. They might argue that the true cost of delayed retirement processing, combined with retaining institutional knowledge, might offset some of the payroll cost. But at the end of the day, the optics of thousands of feds on paid leave for months are difficult to defend administratively.
Regardless of the final accounting, $10 billion in potential waste highlights the internal inefficiency that the administration is clearly targeting. Finally, a minor but important efficiency reform at the Department of Agriculture.
Yes, the USDA Secretary Brooke L. Rollins established the first ever set of standardized general terms and conditions for all USDA grants and cooperative agreements.
And the why here is pretty simple.
It's a pure efficiency play. It's designed to eliminate waste, fraud, and abuse by harmonizing disparate rules across various agencies within USDA, like the Forest Service and Rural Development.
Moving now to the Department of Justice, the year concluded with a major landmark settlement in civil litigation and a push for criminal accountability, especially regarding a high-profile, sensitive file review. Let's start with the Civil Division's action against Disney.
Okay. The what? The DOJ, acting on behalf of the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, finalized a landmark settlement with Disney Worldwide Services and Disney Entertainment Operations for violations of the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, or COPPA.
What were the specifics of the privacy violation and what was the penalty?
The violation was that Disney failed to properly designate child-oriented content things with Mickey Mouse, Frozen as made for kids, on YouTube. By failing to use this designation, they enabled the persistent collection of data and behavioral tracking on viewers under the age of 13.
Which is strictly prohibited without parental consent.
Strictly. And the detail. Disney agreed to a $10 million civil penalty and a permanent injunction.
So the impact of this fine is significant because it fundamentally shifts liability.
It does. This fine fundamentally tells global content producers they are directly responsible for classifying their assets correctly, regardless of which third-party platform like YouTube hosts the content. It mandates Disney establish a rigorous compliance program and reinforces strict liability. It signals a zero-tolerance approach.
Now, onto criminal enforcement updates right before the year closed.
We saw activity across multiple U.S. attorney offices. In the Southern District of Florida, the U.S. attorney cited the recovery of hundreds of millions of dollars in fraud proceeds. In the Northern District of Florida, a Shin Liu was indicted for conspiracy to commit wire fraud.
The pig butchering scams.
Right, specifically defrauding elderly victims via phone and email scams, often linked to that growing global trend. And in D.C., the U.S. Attorney's Office secured the swift arrest of a 16-year-old on first-degree murder charges, underscoring the federal commitment to local violent crime suppression.
Finally, the immense administrative and legal hurdle the DOJ is facing with the Jeffrey Epstein files review. Congress set a deadline, and the department missed it dramatically.
The what? The Department of Justice is seeking to enlist about 400 lawyers, including prosecutors currently working on national security and criminal cases, to review the Epstein files.
And what's the scale of the document dump?
The detail is that the number of documents to be reviewed is reported to be 5.2 million pages. This is a much larger and more precise figure than previous estimates, and it demonstrates the sheer logistical complexity.
Congress required the release by December 19th. Missing that deadline, especially for a case this high profile, has already led to massive political fallout.
Absolutely. Congressman Robert Garcia, the ranking Democrat on the Oversight Committee, was highly critical. He argued the department's actions suggest a massive cover-up and that the president is clearly hiding something, protecting his billionaire buddies.
And the fact that they need 400 lawyers just confirms this review will continue to dominate the news cycle well into 2026.
It confirms it, yes. This will be a major oversight battle.
That sets the stage for a dramatic oversight battle. Let's turn now to the judicial branch and congressional oversight activities, starting with the Supreme Court's annual report, which functions as a critical national barometer.
Chief Justice John G. Roberts Jr. released the 2025 year-end report on the federal judiciary. And this report provides statistical validation for many of the executive actions we've just discussed.
What were the key statistical takeaways regarding caseloads?
Two findings jumped out immediately. First, criminal filings increased by 13% to 79,029 cases, which is the highest level since 2019.
And the driver?
The single biggest driver for this increase was a massive 27% surge in immigration offenses. This statistically validates the executive branch's entire strategy of border enforcement and interior removals.
The judicial system is now absorbing the immense workload generated by DHS apprehensions.
That's right.
And the second major finding relates back directly to the economy and Treasury policy.
Yes. Bankruptcy filings increased by 11%. And crucially, non-business or consumer petitions made up 96% of that total.
Which indicates significant and rising financial stress among American households.
It does. And this data point almost certainly informed Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent's decision to suspend the CTA enforcement for small domestic businesses, an effort to mitigate financial stress on those who might be close to bankruptcy.
Moving to specific lower court litigation, a significant victory for federal union workers occurred right before the holiday regarding the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB.
Right. What? Mm. Judge Amy Berman Jackson ruled against the White House, blocking a highly novel attempt to defund the CFPB.
What was the argument from the White House?
The detail is that the White House, led by Budget Director Russell Vought, argued the CFPB could not draw funds from the Federal Reserve. Their legal theory hinged on the claim that the Fed, operating at a paper loss since 2022, had no combined earnings to fund the CFPB's quarterly payments.
What was Judge Berman Jackson's response to this financial argument?
She ruled definitively that the argument was an unsupported and transparent attempt to starve the CPFB of funding and to circumvent a prior injunction she had issued against mass layoffs at the agency.
So her ruling ensures CFPB employees continue to be paid and the agency remains functional.
It does, while the core union lawsuit over the legality of the layoffs proceeds to trial in February of 2026.
So the administration's attempt to achieve its goal by financial starvation was struck down by the judiciary. We also saw a legal counter-tactic being deployed against the IC enforcement surge we discussed earlier.
That's right. In the District of Minnesota, dozens of immigrants in ICE custody filed habeas corpus petitions on December 31st, demanding immediate release.
And the impact of that?
The impact is a classic legal counter-tactic. Advocacy groups attempting to overwhelm judicial capacity, sometimes called docket flooding, in response to the highly publicized worst-of-the-worst operational surge.
Finally, let's wrap up with congressional oversight and the setting of the legislative agenda for 2026, starting with a key administrative transition in the House.
Yes. The what? Andressendorfer Binstead was sworn in as the new Chief Administrative Officer, or CAO, of the House of Representatives effective December 31st. She's replacing Catherine Spindor.
And the CAO oversees all non-legislative functions, like cybersecurity and finance. So it's a critical transition.
It is, for continuity in House operations.
And the House Oversight Committee wasted no time setting a highly political agenda for the new year regarding alleged social welfare program fraud in Minnesota.
They said two hearings focused on that massive scandal. The first hearing is scheduled for January 7th, where state lawmakers who initially exposed the fraud are expected to testify.
And the second one?
The second, higher profile hearing is set for February 10th. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz and Attorney General Keith Ellison, both Democrats, have been invited to answer tough questions regarding state oversight.
This is a deeply charged partisan issue. Governor Walz has already called the federal crackdown a political ruse to defund programs entirely.
He has. He said the president is politicizing the issue to defund programs that help Minnesotans.
Meanwhile, the White House seems to be escalating the rhetoric.
Well, while Chairman James Comer is focusing on accountability, the rhetoric has escalated. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt endorsed the idea of revoking U.S. citizenship from naturalized Somali Americans convicted of fraud, echoing comments from Congressman Tom Emmer. She stated this is something DHS and the State Department are actively looking at,
signaling a continued whole-of-government enforcement effort tied to this scandal.
That's right. The Senate, meanwhile, held no-floor proceedings and remains in recess, reinforcing the contrast between the executive branch's aggressive pivot and the legislative branch's temporary pause.
So if we step back and connect these dots across the entire government, the actions of December 31st reveal a clear, coherent strategy. It's defined by sovereignty, protectionism, and enforcement as the hallmark of 2026.
Yes, we see this regulatory triage. You have the removal of what the administration considers burdensome regulations for domestic entities, like the CTA suspension, contrasted directly with the hard expiration of the Voluntary Repatriation Incentive Program.
And the Supreme Court report provides justification.
It's exactly. The 27% surge in immigration filings reported by the Supreme Court provides statistical justification for the administration's focus on border and interior enforcement. The financial and regulatory levers are all pulling in one strategic direction.
And linking the infrastructure struggles, the FAA's realization that 80% of its system is obsolete, and the NIH's findings that genomic data access controls were inadequate, it's clear that technological modernization efforts across the government are constantly struggling to keep pace with operational demands.
Which necessitates continuous regulatory triage, whether it's the FAA's strained workforce or HHS's need to issue a fourth temporary extension for telemedicine. The technological debt across government is immense and inescapable.
This raises an important question, especially regarding that massive $1.87 billion Eglin contract award. By cementing the link between the specialized engineering hub of Huntsville, Alabama, and the Florida testing ranges, is the federal government effectively balancing regional economic incentives with the critical need for diversified national security infrastructure?
Or is this concentration of defense spending creating new single points of failure that could be devastating in a crisis? This is something you, the listener, should explore as we move into the first quarter of 2026.
A concentration of capability might be efficient, but vulnerability in wartime is too high a cost. Thank you for this exhaustive deep dive into the archives.
My pleasure.
We'll see you next time on the Deep Dive.